something dangerous has either got into me or was already there? Is it innate? Original sin? I'm getting old. The nostalgic hymns to the purity of my youth, to the purity of the world. Diminuendo before repeated attempts to restore myself and my community. But the insistent ritual places me in an impossible position. My undead father demands I do it again. Preserve me, let me see, drink, revive. But I dissolve in hopeless grief. My yearning to help, a burden, a horror. A wound opens. There is a particularly beautiful horror in the imagery of Zuberberg's film Parsifal. Some of us saw that yesterday across the road. The fairy castles of childhood effloresce out of the tattered, faded postcard images of ruin and destruction. Mass murder and the flood of adult sex haunt the kindergarten. We are seduced in Parsifal from the start. Life is a scandal from the start. We are seduced, partly traumatized, into a life that is too much for us and sets in motion a mystery that sets us on a journey of unpredictable danger. But I am innocent, surely. A wound is a wound. An injured old man is an injured old man. I am startled. I faint before any interpretation of cruelty, of the threatening part object. I would laugh at any suggestion that this is a vagina on a cushion. It is both setting up a terror within me and at the same time beckoning me to pleasures I have never heard of. Why has that kind old man just thrown me out? Marx famously said, in relation to philosophy, that the point is to change the world rather than interpret it. Wagner was no less ambitious than Marx. Wagner was no less ambitious than Marx. His art, though richly interpretable, aimed to influence his audience to the point of changing their personalities. Wagner was part of a movement in the 19th century which had revolutionary aspirations for the human being as well as for society. Darwin had contributed to an ideological thrust which saw the higher evolution of Homo sapiens as inevitable as Marx, inverting Hegel, as we know, had conceived of history as the determinate progenitor and perfecter of society. In the 19th century, evolution and revolution were the watchwords of an inevitable future. Wagner's theories in art and revolution, opera and drama, Jewishness in music, were all, however purely good or dangerously bad, were all part of this intellectual ferment. His early years were on the left. His part in the Dresden Uprising in 1849, along with Bakunin and his friend Roeckel, who edited a radical periodical, earned Wagner 12 years in exile, largely spent in Switzerland. He just missed being arrested. During this time, he turned inward and absorbed the writing of Schopenhauer. Revolutionary fervour was brought into tension with an equally fervent world-denying philosophy of one of history's greatest pessimists. It was a fertile tension, the quest to create a new human being for a new social order for Wagner became riven with perplexity. Despite reactionary times, Wagner still persisted with great, if not grandiose, claims for the transformative power of art, especially his art, and its leading role in social change or revolution. For us, well over a century and a half later, Wagner the artist has perhaps subsumed the ideologue, whether characterized variously as utopian socialist or proto-fascist. Nevertheless, the continuing hold of the operas, their ability to fascinate us, I would argue, still has the power to make us face what animates our own subjective desires and conflicts. The continuing seductive power of the work, the ambition to get into us with a worldview, Weltanschauung, causes controversy to this day. Nietzsche was the first in a line of philosophers for whom Wagner became an ethical and political challenge. So for us here today, how does psychoanalysis come into this? Recent important work on Wagner perhaps helps out that from philosophers who are deeply read in psychoanalysis, like Slavoj Žižek and Alain Badiou, and a generation or two ago, Theodore Adorno. Wagner died in 1883. Freud, less than two decades later, inaugurated the system of ideas and also a practice which, like Marx, aimed at change. Freud's therapeutic aim was apparently modest, much more modest than Marx's aim for society. It was to transform neurotic suffering into ordinary human unhappiness. Throughout its history, however, it must be said that psychoanalysis raised much higher expectations, and not all of them so benign. Putting Wagner and Freud together in this conference is perhaps as problematic as putting Wagner and philosophy together. When I interviewed Phyllida Lloyd, who directed a production of The Ring at the English National Opera, sadly it didn't come together. It was really very interesting. I interviewed her at the Site of Contemporary Psychoanalysis, my organisation, about 11 years ago. A Jewish colleague and friend of mine was very upset at this conjunction, because inevitably Wagner is also paired with the idea of Germany, the political idea of Germany. Adorno, a fine musician as well as a great 20th century philosopher, put the question, after the war, is poetry perhaps standing for all art, is poetry possible after Auschwitz? He later modified this in a 1960 paper called Wagner's Relevance Today to Can One Live After Auschwitz? Parsifal focuses these questions more acutely than any of the other of Wagner operas. It was written after German unification in 1871, and specifically for Bayreuth, a temple to Wagner's art, and Bayreuth being his own home there. Wagner's life, of course, was anything but settled. Like his many characters, he was an itinerant, an émigré, an exile, like Wotan, a wanderer. Parsifal is a story of departure and return after a journey of transformation. We start with a community in crisis. There is this long interim, act two, the seduction that Tom has outlined for us very interestingly. And at the end, a kind of resolution. The king, Amfortas, fallen through the sin of the flesh, healed and redeemed by one who has renounced temptation, sex, and because of this, re-established the health of the community. The word health is perhaps our contemporary preoccupation with something that we're here calling purity. A body. It was very interesting you talking about menstruation and the experience of that in the 19th century, for example. But purity and health, constituting a body free of infection, clear of what is other to the organism, transposed onto society, it can become a body politic, cleansed of outside danger. In Parsifal, as in many of the operas, attempts to resolve the antinomy, the conflict, the antagonism at the root of the individual and society, is often figured as an agonized internal split between sexual love and spiritual love. The resolutions have romantic, redemptive qualities. But modern productions articulate the strains and contradictions that these resolutions present. In the 1980s, there was a production of The Flying Dutchman, The Fliegende Holländer by Harry Cook. Instead of redemptive union with the Dutchman in the waves at the end, Senta simply threw herself out of a window onto the hard street below. The neighbours see this and slam the shutters to see it and ignore it. It provides no lift. We're supposed to be sort of lifted lyrically, but for the characters on the stage, this is the end. No redemption. This led to, I rather like this ending, but it led to a huge row with a friend of mine who saw it at the same time and thought he'd been cheated at the great Wagnerian ending. Jean-Pierre Parnell's ending in Tristan and Isolde, also in the 80s, there is no mystic union of love in death. Isolde's arrival at the end is staged as a male fantasy. Cherith's Twilight of the Gods confronts the audience, the crowd at the end witnessing Brunhilde's transformative immolation. The fire dies down, and the assembled crowd turns towards the audience with a dawning question about what's now possible. Humanity. Perhaps an optimistic ending. As Wagner's thinking and his music became more complex, so the endings of the operas became more problematic. It's well known that there were several different endings tried out for The Ring, for example. Tristan and Parsifal owe much to Wagner's reading of Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's concept of the will is almost embodied in the development of the texture and the complexity of the orchestra. And that's first very evident in Tristan. Tristan as well, harmonically, we know, sort of sustains a sort of huge tension over the length of the opera, traversing perhaps the outer reaches of tonality before reaching his final chord. I don't know whether anyone saw the production currently at the English National Opera. In Act Two, Tristan and Isolde come out of the great duet, which is sort of contained in this huge sort of egg-like kind of thing. It's designed by Anish Kapoor. And as they sort of, as their identities are dissolving, they're interchanging each other, I'm Isolde, you're Tristan kind of thing. They're being pulled towards the orchestra as though they're about to sort of dive into it before they're interrupted by the arrival of King Mark, Daybreak, and the retinue. This sort of dissolving in the music, it sort of goes further in Parsifal. There's a sort of kind of nostalgia about the work. We're reminded of early music, but actually it's coming apart. Instrumental timbre, meter, rhythm, sort of reveals themselves in a sort of huge unfolding from the opening bars. I mean, we heard that there. You can't tell what the time signature is, for example. And it sets in motion a kind of contemplative mode, but also one of foreboding. And the opera's got a sort of feel of an improvisatory process, which is also integral to the way character is delineated, not as a stock type, as in earlier opera, but as a revealed and unstable subjectivity. We know this time and again from the great passages of recall in Wagner, Wotan in Act Two of The Valkyrie, perhaps Isolde in Act One of Isolde, this sort of recalling of the story so far, which leads the character to a sort of new place, perhaps a decision at the end of it. And the sort of form of it goes along with the narration, and it opens up musically along the way. There's no sort of set piece in which that's contained. It sort of unfolds. So you have this psalmodic single line in the strings at the beginning, lightly coloured by woodwind, and it provokes a kind of alert expectancy. And in bar, I can't remember which bar it is, bar three or four or five, there's a sort of semitone. I think it's sometimes described as the spear motive, the kind of anguish which gets to our modern condition, even though it's sort of evoking a sort of an older kind of music. So the key and the time signature are not clear, but then it expands. There's this wonderful sort of sonorous beauty, but increasing this aching sort of nostalgic tone. The erotic, entwined with the pull of death in Parsifal and interest in Isolde, anticipates Freud's final dualistic theory of the forces that drive human life. Eros and the death drive. Eros and Thanatos. With the advent of psychoanalysis, we can perhaps discern what troubles human subjects, both individually and in groups. That the border between these two forces, Eros and Thanatos, is a difficult one to maintain. Eros is supposed to bind, the death drive unbinds us. So the binding forces of Eros in intercourse, fellowship, civilization, is constantly traversed by its apparent opposition. Perversion, invasion, war, and indifference to suffering. These forces may be at work in our current life with its desires and disillusionments, but the tone always has a reminiscent quality unless we just blindly repeat it. Time, in psychoanalysis, and this is sort of prefigured, I think, in the 19th century, particularly Wagner's operas, time is never just chronological. Crises or traumas always evoke previous crises, which have perhaps not been triggered. We live in afterwardsness, and that is Jean Laplanche's translation of Freud's term, which is difficult to translate in English, called Nachträglichkeit, a sort of retroactive kind of feeling. Something has happened. This has happened before. Zubovic's film of Parsifal vividly evokes this. Blurred photographs of destruction, of German cities, as the music begins, that music you just heard, as a sort of ghostly aftertone, an afterwards kind of music. After trauma so deep, so destructive and total. Amfortas' agony returns him from one viewpoint to an infantile state, to a helpless kind of appeal. From another, psychoanalytic viewpoint, his agony shares the same terrain as his ecstasy. He and we, the audience, in listening to this and in identification, being moved by the music, are both saturated and addicted to more. It's both his and our pleasure in horror, disgust at desire. Wagner turns this, let's call it jouissance, Lacan's term for this sort of, again, an untranslatable term, for this kind of suffering which is addictive, which we can't let go of. Wagner turns it into a sort of great speech in music. The music could seduce us into staying with it, as therapists like to say. But it moves on. We learn how trapped Amfortas is. His father, Titurel, has a desire for just one more view, one more hit from the Grail, which reveals a version of the father there, sort of what we're saying at the end, who binds his son to an unending debt, where there's a kind of obscenity to it. Just one more time, won't let go. So how is Amfortas' appeal going to be heard? Is he ever going to get out of this? It is answered enigmatically. We hear it first in Gunnlass's narration, Durch Mitleid wissend der Weine Tor, through suffering with, through compassion, the perfect fool. Perfect fool. This heralds the arrival of Parsifal in Act 1. Parsifal, is asked some questions by Gurdas. He doesn't know his name, nor that of his father, but he can name his mother. Hetzelida, heart suffering. But he has no idea what this means until someone else, Kundry, tells him. He has no intuition of what we, the listeners, feel about this. Our, perhaps, compassion for him, and I must say, I found looking at Act 1 yesterday, very moving, that scene with Parsifal. It's something that he does not yet know about himself or feel about himself or others. Like all fools, he hasn't yet heard another and so yet conceived of himself as other to other people. His namelessness and naive dangerousness, the shooting of the swan, erupt into the mournful texture of Act 1. Durch Mitleidwissen der reine Tor is described, Kotziget, is described as the prophecy motive. It performs the function of a message, however, a kind of enigmatic message. It first emerges from, as we said, from the suffering of Anathematas as a kind of religious auditory hallucination. Suffering so great that he can only dream of a future. Mitleid means compassion. The music here evokes a kind of stillness, purity, which is vulnerable to movement at any time, to be swept away by violence or passion. There are many debates about Christianity in Parsifal. But Wagner's emotion in Schopenhauer sort of was in terms of Schopenhauer was the first Western philosopher to take up Buddhist and Hindu philosophy. An enigmatic message in Durch Mitleidwissen is perhaps material for meditation, the idea being that if one trains one's mind on it, compassion will start to spread and it will arrive. But it won't arrive in any way one might consciously expect. Grunematz has an inkling about it, but at the end of Act 1, Parsifal fails the test and he turns him out. Grunematz also sings a sort of paean to benevolent nature. This is after he's trying to sort of teach Parsifal about the creation. You know, why is he harmed, this swan? And here again, it's a sort of Buddhist influence, loving kindness extending to all beings of whatever species. Of course, the great irony is Wagner's anti-Semitism. But he's not the first or last to propose a universal compassion, only to promote a hateful exception which leads to catastrophe. And perhaps the problem with any system of thought, including psychoanalysis, which aims at resolution, full analysis, for example, or in today's fashion, integration, the purity of the aim, universal spirit in Hegel, dissolution of the class struggle in communism, is unconsciously constituted by a dangerous outside. The kulak, the Jew, the Muslim, the Palestinian, the queer, and right here and now, of course in Britain, the migrant. Wagner's dramas of redemption are repeated attempts to address the splits, usually in the male subject, between different callings of love. You mentioned Tannhäuser. We think of the chorus off stage in Tannhäuser, and then the allure of the Venusberg. Act 2 of Parsifal goes furthest into this, and it has implications for both Parsifal and Kundry. As Stommers outlined, in Act 2, Kundry cuts through the flower maiden's sort of chorus at the end of that garden scene just by her call, Parsifal. The flower maidens are unremitting in their seductive wiles. But the music has a peculiarly dainty, erotic lilt to it. It's sex without erections or excretions of any kind. It's in A-flat, and so has a resonance with the simplicity of the hymn to purity, the simple ascending Dresden Amen motive, which is associated with Grail. This opens the question again psychoanalytically. Are seduction and sublimation in the same key? Freud surely helps us out here in theory. Wagner effectively describes it in music. How close these two are, one sliding into the other. Wagner is able to evoke experiences which can quickly pall. if anyone talks about their sort of wonderful drug experiences, you'll have a sense of that. Or their wonderful spiritual experiences. What Wagner does is to create just enough allure that if the music in either dimension went on any longer, it would drag. Lacan again helps us here. The jouissance, for example, of the endless chemsex party, or the interminable Orthodox mass or Tibetan puja. So purity and danger, what I'm saying is that purity and danger here are exemplified as a pair that are merely the apparent converse. But the desire is always to sort of keep them apart, to split them, to create a split, which, you know, Melanie Klein will sort of outline in very intricate ways. Condrey's call has a double effect. She addresses it to the boy, but it doubles back on her. It's already a new signifier, and he says, well, he thinks he heard it in a dream, but I think, if I remember rightly, that the nomination actually comes from Gamiret. You call the boy from the father. So it is the father's naming. And so it's already a new name, a new signifier, and it does signify. She breaks it down. She parses it, fal parsi, which is affecting the caller as well as the called. She's ostensibly led by the designs of Klingsor's quest for power over the Holy Order. However, another event is in movement. Brecht, in his dramas, talked about an event on stage. There's always another event behind the event, a kind of dialectical movement. The behaviour of the music suggests a Freudian perspective. What cannot be at that moment consciously known to Kundry, and her name evokes knowledge, is that she, the caller, under orders from the one who's calling the tune, Klingsor, starts to receive her own message later, a call from Parsifal, though he never actually calls her by name. The call is a form of a possible future, a possibility that is not completely overdetermined by the past. Parsifal, the opera, is not a tragedy. The male subject, Parsifal, lives on, unlike his brother in fearless Daphnis, Siegfried, who is killed by Hagen. We can compare Parsifal perhaps to the late works of Shakespeare. The jealousy that kills Othello leads Leontes in The Winter's Tale, certainly into 18 years of suffering, but not death. His rage at the imagined infidelity of his wife freezes life, both his and hers. She becomes a statue. She's melted at the end when he kisses the statue and shrieks and shouts. It's a very moving moment. She's warm. So there's no predetermination, no basic fault. In the calling, Kundry herself starts a movement of if you're familiar with the works of Michel Foucault, what Foucault calls subjectivation. It doesn't go much further than the end of Act 2, because in Act 3, it's minimal. In fact, there's no music. There's the howls, the shrieks, which are extraordinary. I mean, you talked about the Mark Elvis' rehearsal of them. And I think in Act 3, you can almost be seen as a way of Wagner resigning before the enormity of the question, perhaps the question of sexual difference, and Wagner couldn't write anything more for her. It is remarkable that Parsifal has an emotional life which never, of course, gets as far as jealousy, envy, anger, because he renounces everything that might lead to this sexual intimacy. Brunhilde, in The Ring, who is conceived as a willing extension of Wotan's will to power, breaks free of him when she discovers love and passion. But Parsifal, perhaps, is a Wunschkind. Brunhilde was Wotan's Wunschkind. Parsifal is a Wunschkind, a wish child of Wagner himself, a pure signifier for the desire to resolve the age-old dangers in human affairs. An answer to madness, sexual desire, power. As I noted earlier, the thinkers of the time, contemporary to Wagner, Marx and Darwin, were driven by a view of nature, society, and the human being as evolving to higher unities, perfectibility, free of class conflict, neurotic conflict, a sort of teleology of purity. We know that the opposite happened in the 20th century and beyond. Parsifal turns away from Kundry and the dangers of King Saul's garden. Sex is the wound, and he is now on a pilgrim's progress, a chaste pilgrim's progress, his purity untouched. He has recovered the spear, and henceforth it will not be used in any battle he is embroiled in from then on. It remains suspended from its real and symbolic utility, fanning, wounding, penetrating. So Parsifal is called. Henceforth he will not be a developed subject as a human being, subject to affects like jealousy. He will be an idiot savant, an exemplar or signifier of purity. This being Wagner's final opera, it can be seen as one of the most radical essays in a 19th century grand project, a reorganisation of society or a restoration of an old, longed-for order, going either right or left. At its worst, at the end of Parsifal, the euphony, Boulez apparently sort of found it a bit saccharine when he was doing Parsifal at Bayreuth. The beautifully uncomplicated grail revelation at the end sort of ignores the unforeseen dangers we know about in the 20th century. Not just communism or fascism, Stalinism or fascism, but any movement towards conformity, the absolutism of identity, the fear of mixing, intrusion, immigration. A thing, you know, we can all think about now we have our Kundry back. At best, the ending points to something new. The ending of Parsifal points to something new. An order beyond the kind of binary conflicts which are so obvious to us in the way power is lived and deployed on a subjective and a social level. It evokes the ending a sort of new, a new reign of gentleness. The music at times is incredibly, incredibly moving through this sort of suspended, floating gentleness. A mutation in a sort of Leben's philosophy, a life philosophy, where sexuality or even gender is the compulsive denominator of identity and intelligibility. Parsifal, having conquered all his external enemies, has, like a good Buddhist, or dare I say, like the Nietzschean Übermensch, he has conquered himself, particularly in his renunciation of sexuality. He is an element in a new myth where purity and innocence has power, according to Wagner. So sexuality no longer persists as the truth of our being, a potentially dangerous internal other doomed to return as a threat, figured by Klingsor. By the end of his life, Wagner had perhaps exhausted all the repetitions of these conflicts, his preoccupations. At the end of Parsifal, there is a promise of the redemption of redemption itself. Off the wheel of life, no need to go round again. That's the hope. One could say that music was to change forever after Wagner. No more the violent conflict that had broken open so fiercely with Beethoven. My ending here, at the end of this paper, returns to the psychoanalytic consulting room. That is perhaps where I am called. Is there a pure analyst? If he or she were, would she be a psychoanalytic fool? Here is a possible conclusion. I hope wisely hesitant. My patient's wishes and hopes for redemption, solutions, resolutions, are at best received by me in a gentle way. No answers may be given. Instead, old and recurring antagonisms, illusions and splits are listened to and responded to in a way that will allow them to unfold slowly in all their dissonance and rich polyphony.
Right, so We have a couple of minutes. I know we're running a bit behind time, but perhaps we have a couple of minutes of questions before the tea break. I'll jump in again then, in that case. So, I was just thinking, I mean, Wagner has obviously written Lohengrin before Parsifal, who's Parsifal's son. Would that have had an effect? I mean, I often think about it. So on one hand, there's a sense of renunciation and becoming asexual. And on the other hand, the person who's writing that, Wagner, is writing about somebody who's, you know, he's already written about his son, and, you know, decades before. I'm just wondering whether there's another way of thinking about it. And the other way of thinking about it is, what does it require, what does a human being have to go through in order to enter a sexual life without danger? You know, what has to be gone through to be able to enter a sexual life? And of course, what has to be gone through, as any development would entail, is some form of renunciation, sacrifice, and so on. You know, but
experience, repetition. Remembering, I mean, you know, getting into trouble, I suppose, and then getting out of it again and again and again. I mean, that's sort of the experience of life and psychoanalysis. But, so who is Lohengrin's mother?
Well, is anybody, Barry, you're the only person who might. Who is Lohengrin's mother? That's a great question.
Was the Immaculate Conception?
No, not at all. I think it's in the old, there's all medieval legends.
Yeah.
There is a genealogy, and yeah. I think Wagner must have been picking up on those. And I'm afraid I do not have that at my fingertips, but I think it's in there.
Yeah, now obviously there's no reason.
It's a miracle.
A miracle, that's what I thought.
But there's no reason to think, anyway, that affected the way we need to think about Pascal. I'm just saying it's a possibility, which leads to this other possibility of thinking it's not just to do with renunciation of anything sexual, but actually a renunciation of something that is required in order to enter a sexual life.
There's something about, I mean, Wagner, you know, obviously he was sort of troubled.
Yes.
And his reading of Schopenhauer, there was going to be an opera about the Buddha, wasn't it? Die Siege, but it didn't happen. But he said he'd kind of put it into, pass it into all those ideas into Parsifal. I mean, and the whole heat around sort of, and Freud's theory, you know, this antinomy, this binary, it sort of shot through with sort of, you know, Western philosophy and ideas about identity, and sexuality being at the core. Freud sort of seems to nail it. It's a theory of psychoanalysis. But then there are later ideas. I mean, it's not about giving up sex, but a sort of, is it really that's the truth of our identity? The core, having castration, Oedipus complex, and so on. Not everybody thinks that's the universal. And Foucault argues with it in the history of sexuality. He tries to sort of displace it rather than desire, which is what Parsifal, Tristan, is all about, being at the sort of core, the driving force for everything. It's a sort of it's a kind of regime of pleasures. I mean, that itself is very, very problematic. So there are, and this idea of a sort of a gentler order, you know, the end of Parsifal. The only problem is at the end of the desire and conflict and music as we know it.
I think Tom in the afternoon is going to be undermining some of those ideas of a gentle order, but for now I think we need a gentle cup of tea on this.